Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is writer and journalist Emma Maris, and we're talking about her book, Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. Emma, welcome back to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
I'm glad to be back.
In this book, you write that we have, quote, misplaced nature. Explain that. In what way have we misplaced nature?
Well, I think that we have many of us have come to conceptualize nature in this really kind of narrow way, which makes it difficult for us to see it or find it in the real world, because even when we're standing in a place surrounded by trees and flowers and birds, we might not think it counts as nature because it's not pure enough.
It's really interesting because in this book, you go to many different places around the planet, Poland, Netherlands, Hawaii, and in every one of those locations, people are trying to restore a chunk of habitat back to some previous condition. And you ask the really embarrassing and tough question is, what baseline are you bringing it back to, and how are you determining that, and are you expecting nature to be static?
Right, yeah. The real question motivating this whole book was, can you put the toothpaste back in the tube? Can you go back?
Well, you can make a simulacrum of putting the toothpaste back in the tube, but as you find out time and again in the book, first of all, these baselines to which they're trying to return it is always a little bit sketchy. Like, is it before the Europeans landed in North America? Is it before humans were in North America? Is it before X, Y, and what? Why are you trying to restore it at this point? Now, you often say that the people who are actually working in the projects have a less parochial idea of nature than the people who are supporting the projects.
That's right. I mean, I think people who do conservation and restoration work for a living have a pretty clear understanding that you can't magically restore a place to, you know, year X, whether that be 1491 or whether that be 1850 or what have you. There's a lot of pragmatic compromises that are made in these restoration projects, or in, for example, deciding whether a piece of land should qualify as wilderness under the Wilderness Act. So there's a much more of a gradient of naturalness or wildness that I think the professionals tend to think along, whereas somebody like myself at age 20 really expected a kind of an unrealistic level of purity or untouchedness. Something that I think is actually kind of promulgated by nature documentaries and other media that I absorbed very happily as a young person, and that kind of gave me this idea that there were these places out there that were completely untouched by human hands.
Is that the key thing? It has to be untouched by human hands.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's that's how I thought about it before I got into this project. And there's so many things wrong with that.
Well, first of all, they're usually you know, native peoples of that area who've been there for several thousands of years. Let's take North America for example.
Exactly. And this is a key problem with this whole let's restore it back to the past, is that for the vast majority of actual projects in, so for example, let's stick with North America, people are trying to restore it back to the condition it was in before white people showed up. That's often very explicitly stated if you dig down deep enough into how they're setting their reference dates or their historical range of variability or whatever kind of buzzword that they're using to talk about their goals. If you dig back into how they're defining that, it's usually the pre-colonial condition. And the problem with that is that, you know, it kind of implies that Native people did not affect their environment in a meaningful way, which is just false. It's just not, it's scientifically inaccurate. All across the country, Indigenous people affected their environment in profound ways, from, you know, burning regimes to regulated hunting, right, to moving of plants and animals all around on the landscape. It was a humanized place when white people got here.
One of the great things I think you do in this book is that you, in, for North America, you trace back the historical ideas of what people thought about when they thought about wilderness, when they thought about nature. And you start with historical writers and philosophers, people like Ralph Waldo Emerson and Thoreau, and people like John Muir. What were their ideas of what wilderness was?
So
because I think these people have affected us incredibly.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I mean, you still see John Muir and Thoreau's quotes on mugs and T-shirts all the time, right? Like, they're still with us on a daily basis. But many of these guys were completely dismissive of Native people as anybody, as having any agency. Muir in particular,
right,
you know, wrote very disparagingly about the Native people in the Sierras that he loved so much. So they really did see the landscapes that sort of Europeans first saw as a virgin wilderness. And they saw it as a sort of a transcendently beautiful place, partly because they saw it as untouched by human hands, because they didn't count Native people, because they, like so many of their contemporaries, were just profoundly bigoted against Native people.
It was later thought, like, wilderness, and this is using your own words, was salubrious, which I think is always a weird word to use. Anyways, it's very oily. But yeah, an important person in that regard is Teddy Roosevelt.
Right.
And when he started up the idea of national parks, what did he think the national parks should do for the people in America?
You know, there was this whole national narrative that the reason that Americans were great and tough and innovative and all of these things was because they had to struggle with the frontier and with the sort of raw nature on the westward edge of the nation, of the growing nation. And this whole kind of frontier mythos, I think, really is still around in some ways, this idea that you go to the wilderness to fight against the elements, to prove your manhood, your masculinity, and to become tough, and that this makes Americans better than these sort of effete, urbanized Europeans that don't know how to wrestle a grizzly bear or survive in the woods.
And we should emphasize, it was definitely a male-only thing.
Yeah, I'm very much so. You know, I mean, I think if you read Teddy Roosevelt, it's very clear that he sees the wilderness as not only a place where you can become healthy and vigorous, but also where you can prove your manhood.
What was the Yellowstone model?
So the Yellowstone model is this, you know, the Yellowstone was the first national park, and this idea really was that, we're shooting all of the game. We need some reserves where some of these majestic animals that we like to shoot can breed and multiply so that we can continue to shoot them in perpetuity. But pretty quickly, you know, the idea really became, hey, we need to have places where this beautiful wilderness that defines America and where we can become Americans is prevented from being developed. And so we need to kick all the people out. So if there are any Native people living here, they need to go. And there can be no use whatsoever in these areas. And we're basically going to put a fence around them. And the kind of assumption was that if we do that, then everything inside the fence will take care of itself. The balance of nature will prevail. It will be unchangingly wild forever.
And you visited some places I know and some places I had never heard of, where this becomes really obvious, and I want to talk about a couple of them in turn. The Scotia Sanctuary in Australia, which is a 250-square-mile tract, fenced in completely.
Right.
And what's going on there?
Well, Australia is a really – I've gone back to Australia many, many times.
I've been there three times.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating place. And part of the reason that it's really interesting is because they're dealing with just an incredible amount of environmental change. And they're also, you know, one of their biggest issues there is introduced predators, cats, foxes. So in order to preserve, these introduced predators are just totally fatal to the local small Native animals. They just cannot coexist. The local small animals just kind of blanket them and become lunch. So in order to preserve those Native animals, they've had to build these incredible fenced reserves, massive areas with serious kind of high-grade fencing around them, and then they've had to kill all of the cats and foxes inside the fence. So you get this kind of situation where it's it's 2021 outside the fence, but as soon as you go through the gates, they're trying to make it seem as if it's before, again, before Europeans showed up, before Captain Cook stepped off the boat.
But it has a weird psychological effect. And when I read about it, it certainly seemed like the area seems to be becoming a de facto zoo. In other words, the fences will never come down.
Right. I mean, this is the real, the kind of the big struggle of Australian conservation is, okay, fine, we can make these fence reserves if we throw enough money at them, but they will always be a kind of the human-managed space. Humans can't walk away from this necessarily because they have to keep guarding against incursion by cats and foxes. They need to keep repairing the fences. And they need to deal with the fact that without other predators in these spaces, they sometimes get wild overpopulation of these endangered little critters. So they become, like a large zoo. And that, I think, is something that's emotionally difficult for Australian conservationists. They want these guys to be wild and free and not in these penned reserves, even very large penned reserves.
But throughout your book, this is the reality. And it's not like there's a judgment that this is necessarily a bad thing, but that we have to be honest about what we're doing. We're not restoring Australia as a whole back to the pre-European settlement of it. We're just taking this tract of land and essentially making it a very complicated zoo.
Yeah, or a museum. So, I mean, I also talk in the book about the huge amount of management that goes on in a place like Yellowstone. You know, we think of Yellowstone as being really wild, but there's a huge amount of labor that goes into that. Removing non-native species, there's a lot of management of the bison and the elk, and they round them up with helicopters, and, you know, they're reintroducing wolves, and then they've got all the wolves with GPS collars, and, I mean, it takes a huge core of full-time employees to keep that place untouched by human hands, and there's obviously a paradox there.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is writer and journalist Emma Maris. And we're talking about her book. It's an important book to read, Rambunctious Garden. I love that title. That's a great Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. I think one of the oddest places for me that you went was in the Netherlands. I've been to the Netherlands, and I found it a very strange place to begin with. And I'm going to screw up the pronunciation of this, but it's the Oostvaarderplassen. Is that it?
Yeah, something like that. Oostvaardersplassen. I also screw up the pronunciation. That's just not the easiest language.
I know it's not. But what an odd place.
Yeah. To me, it's a fun place. So basically, as many of your listeners will know, a lot of the Netherlands is kind of land that's been reclaimed from the sea with a series of dikes and other kind of engineering works. And this is a place that has been reclaimed from the sea, but then allowed to kind of, quote unquote, go wild. So it's all below sea level. It's behind dikes, but it's a kind of a grassland savanna. And it's been managed by reintroducing proxies for extinct wild horses and extinct aurochs, which were the sort of, progenitors of modern cattle. And so it's like a... Yeah, it's like an African savanna, with the train to Utrecht in the distance.
Well, this idea of introducing proxy species is one that sort of gets me really, really worried. One of the wild, and many years ago, I interviewed Paul Martin on this.
Oh, cool.
And I didn't know that this plant exists. He had written another book, and he was really trying to get me excited about the idea of this reintroducing megafauna to essentially the prairie center of the United States. And when I first heard you first hear that idea, it's like, wow, that would be sort of cool. Then the impossibility of it really sort of strikes you. And what's key to that, because he's looking at sort of reintroducing the Pleistocene to North America, is this use of proxy animals. Like you would take a contemporary cheetah or an African elephant that would replace a mammoth and the North American cheetahs. And at that point, I don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, well, you're...
You're making an interesting wildlife park.
Yeah, what you're doing is you're kind of gardening, which is why I called the book Rambunctious Garden, right? So a lot of this conservation work is really putting what humans want and desire on the landscape in a way that is not dissimilar to gardening. And I think that is a you know, sometimes when people hear that, they get defensive because they say, no, no, we're doing this for the nature. You know, but are we, how did we pick the 1850 or 1490? These are all human benchmarks. Or in the case of Paul Martin, how did we pick the Pleistocene as the time that we should go back to? These are really putting our visions of what the landscape should be on the landscape.
The other thing is he's requiring a huge amount of land.
Yeah. Yeah, something like that, the sort of Pleistocene rewilding in North America would be a massive scale type operation. But you know what's funny is I don't write about this in the book, but, you know, there's an elephant sanctuary in Tennessee that I've never been to, but it's on my list. That's very large piece of land and where elephants that were in zoos or the circus or whatever go to kind of retire and have more space and have a better life.
Yeah.
And so it's not like there's not some places in North America where we have elephants on the landscape. They're just fenced in again. It's a different kind of land management there.
Right, but they're not standing in for woolly mammoths or mastodon.
No, but I would love to go there and see how they interact with the North American species that they're with. You know, I've actually talked to a friend of mine, Harry Green, who's a scientist about Cornell, about going down there and doing a study about what they like to eat and so on, because we could maybe learn from their habits what it was like to have mammoths in mastodons in North America.
Well, this brings up a series of wild schemes. People are talking about taking the genetic information or breeding back and then literally there's a lot of people working on reestablishing woolly mammoths.
Right.
Or the auroch.
Yeah. The Mammoth Project to Revive and Restore, Stuart Brand and Ryan Phelan are working on that.
And the auroch one sort of was very Germanic, the idea of bringing that back.
So the auroch, you know, this was a species, this is where we get our modern cattle, but it's extinct in Europe. They shot the last one in the 1600s, so it wasn't even that long ago. And there was this scheme to kind of breed cattle back to their wild ancestors. And for a while, the guys running the scheme were a bunch of Nazis because they saw this as kind of, you know, they had this whole weird obsession with a sort of folkloric, mythic European past. And so that fit in with that. So it's you know, again, it goes back to putting human desires onto nature.
Well, I know when you talk to people about it, everybody goes, well, it sounds really cool. But you know, there's a lot of things we can be spending money on in the environment that we have to, as a matter of fact, with the looming climate change. And reestablishing the auroch doesn't seem to be high on my priorities. Plus, the fact, it's like, have you seen the movie Jurassic Park? I mean, it's like...
I mean, I think that, you know, one thing with rambunctious garden is I talk about how these places where we're trying to sort of save or fix nature are often highly managed. And then I have other chapters where I talk about places that we've totally ignored are actually truly wild, weedy places. And one thing that maybe I could have made clearer in the book is that I think that it's okay to have both of them in our world.
Yep, absolutely.
There's not one way to manage land. And in fact, it's smart if we manage the landscape in lots of different ways. So if in some places we're restoring to a particular time, that's fine. In other places, if we're letting the land truly be autonomous and we're letting it change in response to climate change, that's also good. We need to have all of these different approaches going on simultaneously in different places.
I think the big reason is because climate change is going to change everything. So all these schemes that are trying to, you know, push the clock back, they're still facing the big elephant in the room, the big mammoth in the room, is that the climate is going to change.
And
that's, especially in Australia, it seems to be happening faster than in other places except the Arctic. At the end, I want to mention this. There's a great menu of new goals that you have at the end of the book. And I just want to talk about a couple of them because you talk about goals, but necessarily they may not be the best thing to do. Protect the rights of other species. What do you have to say about that?
It's interesting because my newer book, in some ways, you know, Wild Souls, which just came out this year, kind of expands on that point a bit. You know, I think if we say, okay, look, we're not going to try to turn back the clock, then what are we doing? What are our goals when we're trying to, you know, conserve or protect nature? And I think that the kind of like maybe not the most satisfying answer is that it's going to be context dependent. In some places, we're going to be trying to protect recreational values. And in other places, we might be trying to protect endangered species. But one of the things that we might be trying to protect in some places is the kind of the rights of other species to just live their lives and exist. So, for example, there's a great conservation initiative called the Yukon-Yellowstone Corridor that's
right.
trying to protect migratory routes. Now, partly that's because humans love the beauty and epic passion of a migration. But it's also, along the way, it's protecting the sort of rights of these animals to do what they want to do, which is migrate.
You also talk about saving species versus saving ecosystems, and sometimes they're mutually exclusive.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you want to save an entire ecosystem exactly the way it was in year X, that might be impossible, but you might be able to save the species that make up that ecosystem, but they might not all be in the same place anymore. And I think that that's a really challenging notion. But, you know, some species are going to have a lot of flexibility to persist in place, even as the climate warms. Other species are going to have to move north or up the hill in order to persist. And so we're going to see them, these ecosystems, potentially kind of peel apart. But if we're careful and we're smart in how we do our conservation, we can still have all the pieces. They just might not be together in the same assemblages that we're used to.
You talk about efforts to protect genetic diversity, which often amount to protecting samples of DNA, which in the end sounds very depressing.
Yeah. We don't, you know, I mean, no, none of us wants to say, well, we lost all of the tigers and the polar bears and the blue whales, but we have their DNA on file. Like, that doesn't...
As if we're going to do something with it, too, because if we haven't saved some place for them to go, we can't just restore them again, because, again, that's like Jurassic Park. It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
They're just going to be in our zoos. The last one I found really interesting and sort of wonderful, protect the spiritual and aesthetic experience of nature. And I find that really important for me. Personally.
Yeah, and I think it's important for a lot of us. And this is a very broad category. You know, it's everything from like, oh, I want to make sure there's a place for every American to be able to take a walk in the woods. Like, everyone should have the right to be near some trees, that kind of equity of access. But it also includes things like, hey, you know, this tribe over here has a long tradition of gathering this grass to make baskets, so we need to make sure that this grass still exists for them to be able to harvest. So it's a big category that includes deeply religious stuff, as well as just like being able to breathe in a place with some green plants.
We're going to run out of time, but I want you to talk a little bit about Białowieża primeval forest in Poland. It's a place I've always wanted to go, and looms large in my imagination of this, you know, primeval forest. And it was fascinating, the history of the area that you found out.
Yeah, so it's Białowieża, and it's
okay.
Right
thank
on the
you. thank you.
It's right on the border of Poland and Belarus, which people often say, well, it's the last old growth forest in continental Europe. That's how it's sort of advertised. But it does have a very complicated history with tons of human interaction.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah. So you know,
and not only that, it's not all in one country anymore.
Yes, yeah. So it's in different jurisdictions, and there was logging in there, and for a long time it was managed for game, for hunting, for various kings, and then during World War II, there were people hiding in the forest, and it's to me, but and yet it is still an incredibly gorgeous
place
where you feel like the trees are big, they're draped in moss, you can see where the wild pigs have been rooting in the undergrowth,
and there's wild bison.
It's got forest, European forest bison, which are this incredibly rare and magical species. So, I mean, it feels like a Miyazaki movie, honestly, to be there. It's just gorgeous. And I think that the lesson of Białowieża is that, you know, a lot of us have been trained to think that nature only really counts as wild or natural if there's no human history with it. But there's nothing like that anymore. There is human history with all of these places. You know, whether it's Native Americans burning the prairies to keep them open for hunting, or whether it's old, you know, ancient Lithuanian kings hunting in the forest. These, all of these landscapes have a human history, but that doesn't mean that they're not valuable.
Well, and I'm going to read from your book. In the last chapter, here's a quote from your book. Give up romantic notions of a stable Eden. Be honest about goals and costs. Keep land from mindless development and try just about everything. I think that really sums it up. Can you just expand on that for a minute or two?
Yeah, I mean, I really think, you know, sometimes when I tell people, hey, I don't think we should be trying to put everything back the way it was before white people showed up, I think that's a weird goal that doesn't make much sense. They think that I'm saying, hey, anything goes.
Right,
just throw
right.
a bunch of track houses, yep. no problem. And that's absolutely not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that we need to have a lot more flexibility and diversity in our strategies. And in some cases, that's going to mean that ecosystems are changing around us as they are adapting to the changed conditions. But as long as we're not seeing things go extinct, as long as nature, we still need to have places where humans aren't, that aren't for humans, right?
That we're visitors.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, it is probably the case that if you go hike the Appalachian Trail or the Pacific Coast Trail in 100 years, you're going to see a lot different scenery.
Oh, yeah.
But I hope you still won't see, you know, big box stores and parking lots. There's a difference.
With that, we'll sign off. My returning guest tonight has been writer and journalist Emma Maris. And we've been talking about her book, Rambunctious Garden: Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. Emma, it's a pleasure, as always.
Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.